Dispatch Boy. Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios. Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, a show where two retired cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And we have a great show. We have the attorney, the defense attorney for Jody Arias. Arguably one of the biggest cases of the decade, if not the century. Infamous murderers. Then we go into cop talk. We're going to talk to a retired fireman who has a very unusual treatment for first responders suffering from PTS. And then we go into our last segment, the stupid suspects galore, the heroic headlines, and of course, Jason's inspirational close. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome to Badge Boys, everybody. I am beyond excited about this week. We are sitting in studio with a gentleman that I have wanted to meet for a great many years, and they say that opposites attract. I think this is a perfect example. We have in studio with us Kirk Nurmi. And for those of you outside of Arizona and maybe have put the past to rest, he was the lead defense attorney for Jody Arias, which I can't think of a bigger case in Arizona history just because of the media attention and the
a lot of hype.
The brutality of it. It was
sex, murder.
And she's one of the more disgusting human beings.
Thank you.
I've said that before, and I will say that forever. So, but I'll tell you, Darren and Robin, I was glued to this trial as a former homicide investigator and just the media. I mean, I was, would watch headline news because they did a great job covering it. And I obviously, as a former homicide investigator, I'm not a big fan of defense attorneys because I've been asked questions that I didn't appreciate. Or you going all the way back to like the O.J. Simpson trial, you're just like, are you kidding me? How can you say that stuff? How can you do this? So I was enamored in a lot of ways, but I'll be honest with you, Kirk was the one person out of everybody in that courtroom that I always thought, you know what, this is a good guy. What the fuck is he doing there? that was my question. And I'd like to have a beer with him. I want to sit down. I want to ask him some questions. And minus the beer.
Just not a Corona.
Guess what? Minus the beer, here we are in 2020, and I finally get to ask him some questions. So, Kirk, first of all, welcome to our show. And second of all, I have a lot more respect for you that you had the courage to come on our show. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. And I guess it still sounds like you're still going to owe me a beer even after the show's over.
Oh, I have a feeling
maybe a couple.
I want to have a beer more with you than I did even before. So let's jump right into it.
Sure.
How did I come to know you? How did the world come to know you? How did you end up being Jody Arias's defense attorney?
Sure. Back in 2009, I was a capital defense attorney working in the public defender's office. And if you recall back then, Andrew Thomas was our county attorney.
Yeah.
And he charged the death penalty in a lot of cases, and they were increasing the number of attorneys in that unit. So in 2008, I joined the unit, and after about two trials in the unit, in 2009, we had just finished a trial. And my supervisor came walking down the hallway with a file in his hand, and the name on that file was Jody Arias. And of course, in 2009, if you think about it, she wasn't known to me. She wasn't known to most people. She had done a few interviews back in 2008, like right when she was arrested. She had had prior counsel. They withdrew from the case, and it was reassigned to me. So it was basically by order of the court. I used the word trapped with Miss Arias as my book title because in 2011, in the early part of 2011, I had decided that after two trials in the Capitol unit, I was burned out. A Capitol trial lasts 3 or 4 months. Obviously, as you know, they're horrific cases. And when you're talking about the death penalty, then you have the pressure of, yes, the defendant's life. And I'm an opponent of the death penalty. But also, you know that there's so much pain going on both sides of the aisle, even with the defendant's family, that after two trials, it just became too much, and I decided I wanted out. And to make a long story short, the court ordered that I retain the case when I move into private practice. So that's why you came to know me on January 2nd, 2013.
And then did you, just out of quick curiosity, did you handpick your co-counsel?
Well, originally, members of the Public Defender's Office were my co-counsel, and then I was choosing from a list of attorneys that did that sort of work for Maricopa County.
And that's how you ended up with Wilmot doing the trial with you. Okay. So you're against the death penalty. You knew this was a death penalty case. But in this case, which I can't put a percentage on it, but there's not many that were this cut and dry. There was no doubt that she did this and the horrificness of it. So what was your initial, you didn't have much choice here. What was your initial approach 2011, 2012, before the trial even started? How in the world can you defend somebody that you know what they've done? And you saw pictures that I haven't seen, and I've seen some pretty good ones. You saw probably a lot more than what we even know about. And you had private conversations that obviously we're not going to talk about. How do you sit at night? I'm a big believer in, you know, when you're alone with your thoughts, when you're home at the end of the day, what are you picturing providing this person who is entitled to their due process? What was your initial approach going into the trial?
Well, I think most, to back up a little bit, because you had a real long question there, but most capital cases, at least in most jurisdictions, and maybe it wasn't the case in the Andy Thomas era when so many cases were being charged as death penalty cases, most death penalty cases are charged as such because guilt or innocence is pretty obvious in general, right? There's not a lot of dispute, or they wouldn't seek the death penalty. And your question kind of is multifaceted, and it talks about my motivations and any reservations, personal reservations I had. That's how I'm taking your question. So in that regard, I would say that everyone, those due process rights that you just mentioned aren't something that I'm quick to dismiss. They belong to everybody in every situation and every arrest. And I'm a firm believer in those, which is why I became a criminal defense attorney to begin with. Likewise, as I said, as a personal opponent to the death penalty, I certainly had my druthers with that being sought after against Miss Arias. Even when you compared her against other cases of a similar nature where the death penalty wasn't sought, I thought that she having no past criminal record was not someone that worthy of the death penalty. So to answer your question, the focus becomes trying to save her life. And that is not dependent on a defense attorney liking the client or thinking they're innocent or anything else. I use the analogy of a surgeon in an emergency room. He doesn't call time out and interview or do a background check and decide whether he likes the person that's on the table or not. He goes to business of operating. And that's what criminal defense attorneys, in essence, have to do because, you know, we are probably of the ilk that, and most of us are, that we don't hang out with killers. They're not in our friend group. No murderers are going to be invited to have that beer with us, right? So it's not like, hey, this is, you know, some kind of personal cause, which is a lot of people thought, right? And to that I say I must have Oscar-worthy acting talent. Right. People believe that I really believe what she was saying or in her innocence. But the point of fact being, though, it's a matter of doing that job in our system, checks and balances on the system, and really making sure that if someone is sentenced to death, that sentence is appropriate legally. Because what a lot of people don't know is that every sentence of death is automatically reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
So if the attorney doesn't do a vigorous job in representing that person, then the first trial, if you will, or the sentencing becomes moot, and it all has to happen again. So you have to do, you're committed to do your best, you're committed to work towards saving your client's life.
Kirk, I may be the only one in America that didn't watch that trial, and yet I still knew her name. And because she became bigger than life, the trial, the sex, the murder, it all just exploded with the media. Was there I don't want to use the word aha moment, but was there that oh shit moment in your preparation where you realized this is getting huge and all that comes with it in terms of the media, the exposure, it becoming almost a life of its own? Was there a moment early on, or was that something that when it was all said and done, the dust settled, you realized how big of a case this was and how this has affected you personally? And we'll get into that.
Well, I think there were countless oh shit moments throughout the trial. but
I know I said it a lot.
But to the specifics of your question, you know, the trial had been set several different occasions, and I knew that the media collectively had a desire to broadcast it. Various HLN was mentioned, you know, wanting to live stream the trial, that sort of thing. And so there was inquiries, you know, media outlets wanting to take me out to dinner, stuff like that, that kind of thing. But, you know, I never really had a sense of how big it was until that first day of trial, because we had picked a jury in December and the media wasn't allowed to film that or anything. But I remember pulling up to my normal parking spot and walking towards the courthouse and seeing what could have passed as plain food trucks, you know, outside the courthouse, but they were all what they call portable studios, with big satellites beaming the signal everywhere.
It's like a circus.
And so that made it that these people are real. They are going all out, you know. So there was one of kind of those oh shit moments that this is the real deal. But certainly, you know, I can't speak for everyone involved in the trial, but I don't think that anyone would have thought that it would have got this big. Because even though you know it's being televised, and even though you know it's being streamed worldwide, you don't know how much people are going to respond and react to it. And as the trial went on, it was obvious that train had left the station. People were responding and reacting to this case.
All right, so I have another one of my infamous long-winded questions. So when you were answering my question earlier, you talked about her due process, and you want to give her, you don't believe in the death penalty, and you don't believe she deserved to die for this crime. But you know that you're facing a long period of time before you get to that. There's a guilt or innocence phase that you have to go through and defend, and you're up against the prosecutor who is quite infamous because of this case. Can you talk to us about how that takes its toll as you're going through just the daily stuff, like, Jesus Christ, I got to hear this again, or I got to fight this part of it, knowing, I'm at least from my standpoint, I'm sitting at home going, look, she's going to be found guilty. There is no doubt to me that she's going to be found guilty. And you're fighting more, you're looking months, if not years down the road, but you still have to go through the daily grind. And then the second part is, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but at one point, did you either try to get recused from the case, or did she try to fire you like mid-trial?
Okay, well, answering the last part of your question first, I made numerous motions to withdraw.
Okay.
And there was a point in time after the verdict, remember, because she was found guilty of first degree murder, right? And then the jury hung on sentencing. So there was going to be a second sentencing phase, and she sought to have me replaced during that second sentencing phase.
Okay.
Going back to your question about that day-to-day grind and looking at it, yeah, it certainly takes a toll. You know, it was very stressful. It was all-encompassing, too, because when you think about a lot of cases that both of you guys have worked on, you can kind of block it out of your life when you go home or when you're in your car, et cetera. It might be in your head at times. But the Arias trial was one of those things where it wasn't, right? It wasn't that way at all. I'd turn on the TV in the morning just to watch the local news before I go for a run or whatever. And there I was. And I get in my car at the end of the day, and you mentioned HLN earlier, they were on satellite radio. And so I could listen to the testimony on the car and see what experts were saying and maybe even catch a piece that I didn't miss. So it was all encompassing, and it was very stressful because Like if you recall back then, I had a shaved head. I was heavier than I am now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there weren't too many guys, you know, 6'4 with a shaved head walking around, right, that were on TV all the time. So, you know, even going out to dinner or things like that, people approaching you, and most people didn't have a positive opinion of me at that time. You know, they connected me to her and those things we talked about, me believing her, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a time of hypervigilance and stress, no doubt about it, because it was all encompassing. And you know, I was getting death threats in my at this time, I was working at a private practice in an office that was a converted home in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And so, point being, you know, when I was at the public defender's office, there's sheriff's office down there, there's security, there's all that kind of stuff. It was just me in an office. So it was a converted house. And I, you know, I get death threats. I got white powder in the mail. I had to start opening my mail with gloves. The office phone was ringing off the hook. And, you know, I tell you, and we talked earlier about, you know, Darren asked me about the worldwide attention. One of the things that the county requires, or the Superior Court requires, of lawyers is that they put their address and phone number on the pleading. So therefore, my office phone number was well known to people, and they could call with whatever threats or whatever they had. They could email me right away. So I remember times when if I, you know, and I wasn't on social media during the first trial, but if I, say, mispronounced a word or somebody asked a question that somebody in the court of a public opinion didn't like, they could email me in real time and attack me for that. Like, oh, you're stupid. You said this word instead of that word or whatever it was. Yeah, so, I mean, it was a constant state of hypervigilance. And remember, that trial, at least the public portion of it, lasted from January till almost the end of May.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when you talk about this trial and all that adversity you went through, clearly a personal toll it took on you. When we talk about first responders, we always talk about PTS and the trauma and the emotional. I can't help but think you went through that. Yes, no, and
I think that's probably the case. I've never been diagnosed. I remember, you know, I'm familiar with the diagnosis as a lawyer. I had a DSM-4 in my office, the diagnostic manual. And I think that's true. And, you know, I remember, not to jump too far ahead in the story, but the stress of this, I believe, is why cancer came into my life. And they'll say 1 out of 5 cancer patients has PTSD just based on that connection to their mortality that cancer brings. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably true because it was a battle per se. You know, I mean, you know, I kept my head down and just went to work every day.
Did your job.
But yeah, I mean, there was, like I say, there was the threats, there was everything else. My wife was a teacher at the time. She quit her job for security. I mean, people got to the point where they could figure out where my co-counsel's kids went to grade school and were threatening them. So, I mean, it's
threatening the kids.
I know.
Listen, I'm all for hating somebody and not agreeing with the way they're going about, you know, like, for example, there were certain people on the stand that I was either friends with, the experts. You guys had an incredible forensic psychiatrist testify who I am personal friends with. And some of the questions that came from the defense side, I was like, oh, but I would have never got on my computer and sent an email, made a phone call, and I certainly wouldn't. That I just don't relate to. So you go through all of this, and I truly can't imagine. Like, I know what a homicide investigation takes out of you. There is emotional things when you're dealing with the family, and I would see it from a different side. I would be in the house with the victim, and you know, I've made the knocks on the door that changed people's lives forever, and so I have that side of it, and of course, that taints your view of like, I want to get who did this. I want to get them in jail, and I can't wait to go through the trial part. For you, very different being on the other side. But when the guilt or innocence phase was finally coming to a close, was there any sense of just relief in a way? And maybe that's a bad term, but like, all right, now I can get to the phase that I actually know why I'm here, which is I want to save her from the death penalty. Were you glad to see that come to a close? Tired of listening to Juan talk in the guilt or innocence part? Probably tired of listening to her talk because she said she was innocent forever.
Well, let me, there's a lot to say in that question. I want to be clear, though, when you talk about you seeing, as a police officer, you seeing one side of the aisle
right.
and me seeing the other. I also think that at least from my experience, I'm always cognizant, and defense attorneys are always cognizant of the pain of the victim's family. Now, we might not have the opportunity to share that with them based on victims' bill of rights and everything, but, you know, having gone through two death penalty trials and having seen someone sentenced to death and having just the sadness that permeated the courtroom, I experienced firsthand what the death penalty is like, and I don't think there's any real joy in it for anybody. And quite frankly, had she gotten the death penalty, 10 or 15 years worth of appeals down the road, and some of the things that we read in the appellate decision might come back to haunt the whole situation and result in a new trial. So everyone, I think, involved is very fortunate that her appeal was denied and that she wasn't sentenced to death. Yeah. But to get to part of your question, I think, you know, I just wanted it over, period. It wasn't a matter of separation of phases or anything else, because it wasn't any different, right? I mean, I was just, you know, think about this, 5.5 years with her, because 2009 is when the file gets handed to me. And in 2011, I'm thinking that I'm going to leave the case behind and start my private practice. At that time, the trial scheduled 6 months down the road, okay? And that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen until 2013. So I'm thinking, you know, I was going to start I'd be in my private practice, all this stuff. And it just kept going. And I had new co-counsel, kept going and going and going. So that distinction you draw isn't really strong, in the sense that I just wanted the whole crap to be over. And I remember sitting there, because it was going to be a shitstorm no matter what phase it was in, and it'd be nice not to have to go through that every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the biggest disappointments, I guess, I mean, on a professional level, it was great, but when the jury hung as to sentencing, and I knew that the state had another crack at it, I knew I wasn't done, and that was one of the most despondent moments. But after that, when the issue was only death, I was a little bit reinvigorated at that point in time.
Yeah, because you're fighting for something that you strongly believe in, and why you started it, well, you didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
On starting the whole process, but that was your end goal.
Yeah, that's the goal of any criminal, any capital defense attorney.
To get sentenced to death.
You know, I can't help but look at where you're at now, and you look healthy, happy, and I can't help but think there was this incredible metamorphosis, transition, because you are no longer a working attorney. Did Jody Arias destroy your career, and are you better for it, if that's a true statement?
I think, yes, she did destroy my career, and the whole and I can't just isolate it to just her, because it was the whole experience. Because we're going back about 5 years from now. It was like April 15th in 2015 when I was finally done. I finally learned that my motion to withdraw had been granted, and I was done. And I remember, as I was just saying to Jason a few minutes ago, how much I'd wanted to get into my practice for years. Thought maybe, well, okay, 2012, whatever. And here it was, 2015. And I was going for a run that morning and really not feeling any motivation to get back towards the practice of law. You know, I'd been wanting to start this more sedate private practice. And so I thought, okay, I'm burned out. You know, I worked so hard to get a lawyer. I was a lawyer for 15 years. This can't be the transition that's coming my way. I'm going to take some months off, get some rest, and see what happens. And, you know, so I'm a baseball fan, so my wife, and it's killing me, we don't have ball right now, but
there's some weak room, right?
You know, my wife and I took some bucket list trips. We went to Cooperstown and Kansas City, which was where the Negro League Hall of Fame is. And they were spectacular. And I'm saying that just to rub Jason's face in it if he hasn't.
I'm jealous.
Have you? Yeah, okay.
I'm jealous right now.
But be that as it may, we took those trips and came back. And I was thinking, okay, I had one more. I was going to make a trip back to Seattle where I grew up. And that's when I found the lymph node under my armpit was inflamed. And I was prepared to go back to practicing law because I hadn't found anything else. And I really think when you talk about the metamorphosis, and they're all connected, obviously, everything builds on each other, every other thing. But when I found out that I had cancer, you know, I was obviously hoping it wasn't, you know, for those few weeks. But when the reality that it was stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, that I had a 70% chance of survival. I really went to a dark place in my life, and I think this is where the metamorphosis started. I was going on a run and thinking about whether I really wanted to go through chemotherapy. I mean, I thought about all the things that I had been through in my life, beaten down. We talked about the hypervigilance, everything else. And I had no desire to practice law. And here I was, and it's like, did I really want to, in my late 40s, really endeavor to rebuild my life? And if I was going to go through six rounds of chemotherapy, what was the point? Was I going to do that just to live the same life I had lived before? So I gave serious, and it's a dark place, but I gave serious contemplation to not going undergoing chemotherapy, that my time on the earth might be done because, you know, of everything involved. And you know, adding a caveat to that, one thing that I didn't bring up in Jason's last question is, remember at the end of the guilt phase, the first trial, Miss Arias made the choice to blame her decision, her story on me. And remember, that was claiming that Mr. Alexander was an abusive pedophile. To put it quickly, right? And she decided to pin that on me, which caused obviously more stress in my life. So it was like, okay, do I really want to rebuild this, you know? And when I made the decision ultimately to go into the chemo chair and take those six rounds of chemotherapy, one of the things that I wanted to do was to impose truth upon her lies. So, and that was that time when you. I was going through the chemotherapy, I made the decision to write the book, because obviously in Miss Arias, we know she's someone who has a penchant, let's say, shall we say, for denigrating the legacy of the deceased. And I didn't want her to have the opportunity to do that without imposing truth upon her lies. And I figured a book was the best way to do that, because that would obviously live beyond me if that 30%, because that 30% sounds small, but when it's your life, it's huge, right? And so I wanted to make sure that truth was imposed upon her lies, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't living my life the same way. So in contrast to your good for you, the state bar said bad for you, you're a bad guy, look at you writing this stuff, right? And I said, no, look, she disclosed some of this stuff, she talked about all this stuff, and we went around and around. They said, okay, 4-year suspension. And by that time, this was 2016, and I was feeling more connected with who I was, and I remember the promise I made to myself about if I was not going to live my remaining days the way I had my prior, if I survived cancer. So, you know, against my attorney's advice and people thinking I'm crazy, I said, you know what? I don't want my law license anymore. So I actually requested for voluntary disbarment, and that was granted in November of 2016, and that was a damn awesome day.
And you never looked back.
A damn awesome day. No regrets.
Never look back. No regrets.
And
no.
You know, guys, I got to tell you this.
Please.
Because he told me not long ago, because he's a personal friend of mine, and he actually disclosed to me what he did with that law degree. Tell them what you did with that piece of paper.
Oh, yeah.
Where'd you go to law school first?
I went to law school in the University of Wyoming.
Nice. I love that.
Yeah.
That beer's getting bigger.
Yeah. No, seriously. That's so cool. Okay. Now I want to hear.
Now you're going to have some simpatico here. That beer is going to get bigger.
Does he really like Wyoming, or is he just
I have a very personal friend who was he did diving at the University of Wyoming. But I know I love when somebody isn't like, oh, I went to we're sitting here in Phoenix.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that you went to ASU law school. And no disrespect to them. I love hearing. You came from somewhere else, and you have everybody has a story, and this is all part of it. So when you said something that I wasn't expecting, that's why I was like, I love it. So
University of Wyoming.
That's cool.
So Jason, what is your and my simpatico thing? What do we always talk about? You know, he's drawing a blank.
It can't be that simpatico if he doesn't know.
he knows, but this is
being the Phoenix.
The fire thing.
The fire.
Tell him, Kirk, you'll love this.
So I got to the point where I was realizing that, you know, like I said, I didn't want to practice law anymore. And I was going through some of these things. And I'm a firm believer in that when we cut ties with the old, that we need to make space for the new. So, you know, when you're admitted into the bar, they give you this big parchment piece of paper with a little gold seal. State of Arizona says you get to practice law in our state, right? And I'd already gleefully removed the bar card from my wallet and cut that up. You know, all that ever did was get me into the jail to talk to inmates, right? But I didn't tell my wife. I didn't tell anyone. I took the certificate out of the frame, took it back into my backyard, and set it on fire. and just sat there and watched it burn.
I thought you'd like that.
That is awesome. And you sat there by yourself and watched it.
I just sat there by myself and watched it. Didn't give my wife the chance to, you know, talk me out of it or anything else. And it was really amazingly cathartic because I had wanted to be a lawyer, and you know, we could talk all about my history, but since I was like 5 or 6.
Wow.
And had rejections and things like that and all kinds of different roadblocks before I finally got into the University of Wyoming. But point being, that was something I'd wanted for so long, and I realized that I wasn't the same guy that wanted that certificate so badly. So it was very cathartic for me to make room for the new, and that's what I've
and
made room
that
for
is,
now.
And that's how you do it.
Tell us about this book. Where is it available?
Well, I've written 5, so you're going to have to be specific.
As it relates to the trial, the first one, the one that really kind of started this whole new journey for you.
Yeah, Trapped with Miss Arias. I published that in November of 2015 while I was going through chemotherapy. And this was before I had made my battle with cancer public. I'd gone through 3 rounds of chemotherapy, and I came out a couple weeks later after the book, but I came out with the book with the idea that, you know, I was going to impose truth upon her lies and then defend it through interviews and everything else. So
did you think this was going to be a one and done?
Well, it was meant to be part one of three.
Okay.
Because I couldn't get everything I wanted to down. So I, you know, because it was 5 years of my life, right? And it was the first big book I had written, right? And so I just decided to chop it up in parts. And right, so far, we've only published the first part.
And how has your life changed for the better? Can you talk about some of the success? Mr. Inspiration over here, he always talks about. Thank you.
To add on to where Darren's going with this, because this, I did want this to be my final question. I don't believe in comparing situations or things that we've gone through. We all have a story, and we all have our path. I've got it tattooed on my arm that sometimes the most beautiful inspirational changes will disguise themselves as utter devastation. And, you know, people often ask me, why are you so happy now, looking the way you do, or having gone through what you did? You're not a cop anymore, which is what you thought you would do forever. Similar to, I'm sure you graduated law school, you passed the bar exam, you're going to be a lawyer forever.
Yeah.
But we all have a story. We all go through changes. But when I look back on life, I don't think about the bad things that I saw. I don't think about catching on fire. I don't think about my accident or my trial. I think about why I put my name on the application, how proud I am of that, and that, you know what, I did it for the time that I did it, and I'm where I'm at now. And I find tremendous inspiration and peace and serenity, all the things that I search for every day. Where you're at now, and with your happiness, you overcoming cancer and not being a lawyer, just all things encompassing. Are you similar? Like, do you think back to, I'm glad I did it, not the Jodi Arias trial, going to law school, all the work, all the setbacks and the rejection, and the fact that you're not an attorney now, is that something that bothers you? Or like me, are you like, you know what, I'm still glad that I did everything I did?
I'm still glad that I did everything I did. You know, I think what I would say to that in general is that I'm grateful for the lessons that came out of the experience, you know, and I think that's the best way they can serve us, when we look at them for the lessons. Yeah. You know, I something came to mind the other day that I posted. I said, drop your history and embrace the mystery. And what I mean by that is sometimes we cling too much to our history. We let it hold us back. We let those bad things that happened to us hold us back. And one of the things that is a reality when we make these changes in life, right? You're not a police officer anymore. There's a mystery to it. What's it going to be?
Yeah.
And egoically, as humans, we tend to be so scared to make that shift because we don't know what's going to happen, right? Yeah. People stay in relationships because we don't know what's going to happen. People stay in jobs that they hate. They're miserable. And not because of trauma or anything else, but because they're living out, like you said, you know, they graduated, say they got an accounting degree, and 10 years down the road, they hate accounting, but they can't make the same money doing everywhere else. And they're just unhappy with their life,
right?
But they don't want to leave because they fear the uncertainty of leaving. And one of the things that has been a great part of my growth that I've experienced this the last couple of months is really falling in love with that mystery, because I don't know where it's going to take me.
That is so incredible. Your answers, your vulnerability, your honesty is just incredible. I'll tell you, if you ever did want to be a lawyer again, you'd make a great prosecutor. Trust me.
he prosecutes me.
That left you speechless. He's over here wanting to go. Hell no, I'm not going to be a
leave
prosecutor.
The dark side.
Well, come to the light, damn it. We need help over here.
You know what though? It doesn't matter which side of the coin you'd be talking about. I have no interest in either side of the coin.
Not doing it again.
Not doing it again.
You love your life.
That's you love your life now. And that's
And I just have no desire to be back in the courtroom. And you're right to point out that I'd be a great prosecutor if I was on the other side of the aisle.
I think you'd do a hell of a job.
But at the same time, you know, that part of my life, that aspect of my life is over. That chapter, that's what I say, dropped my history. That history is dropped. I don't revisit that.
Well, I'll tell you, and Darren and Robin can attest to this. I've said this for months and months, and I will gloat a little bit on my, I pride myself on being a good judge of character, and I was proven right today because you did conduct yourself in an honorable way in that courtroom throughout that trial, and I don't say that about too many criminal defense attorneys because I've had bad experiences, but I think you did the best job you could. I'm sorry for what you went through. Somebody had to go through it, though. Somebody had to be in that courtroom. You conducted yourself in an honorable way. I have a lot of respect for you, and you've overcome a lot in life, and it truly is. It's just great to meet you. Yeah. I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad that we talked, and we are going to go as soon as this quarantine is lifted. I will buy you a gigantic beer, and we'll talk about things off the record.
And baseball.
And yes, we can talk about our misery. That's what I'm most miserable about, right? Last night, I watched the 1995 Orioles-Angels game that Cal Ripken set the record for 2,131 consecutive games. And my wife was like, what the hell are you doing? I'm like, just shut up and let me enjoy a baseball game because I'm going crazy. So I can respect that part of it.
Well, I appreciate all that. I'm honored by your words and appreciate that. And you're right. Somebody had to do it. And, you know, we don't always know why we're the ones put in the positions we are in. But we have that choice to, as I said before, move forward and make those changes and make room for those changes and lovingly embrace them and know that we're going to be protected and directed. And, you know, that's how I live my life now. And, you know, you're an inspiration to me as well.
Thank you.
Given everything you've gone through and what you do. And it's not always what happens to us, but it's how we share those gifts with the world. And you've done that. And it's certainly my intention as well to do that moving forward.
Well, and you know, said the key word, be grateful.
I've often thought about this. Without that trial, I don't think I would have ever met you, Kirk. I really don't.
No.
Yeah, you would not be in my life today,
we
Kirk.
None of us would.
No, I wouldn't know who you are, and you and I wouldn't have become friends, and you wouldn't be sitting here today with us. Isn't that crazy?
That's true, and that's why I talk about embracing the mystery, because you never know. And it's a weird thing to say, because I was talking to a couple of other friends. You know, I met some true crime writers and all different people because of this. And it's a weird thing to say that out of such tragedy, I've made such great friendships and connections. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
I truly believe what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah. And you survived Jody Arias.
It is very true. You survived Jody Arias. Survived cancer. We've all survived our stuff. And everybody's listening has survived their stuff. So I hope they all got all of our... You should get a lot out of this show. This is a good one. And I can't thank you enough, truly. This
thank you for joining us, Kirk.
Well, I'm honored that two rusty old officers would have me in
here. We will be right back with our next guest.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget.
Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
My first call up ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Rob and Darren, I just can't tell you how much I loved that segment. And now that Mr. Nurmi is gone and I can successfully talk behind his back, I would like to say that I really do. I respect that guy a lot, and I really enjoyed meeting him. I really enjoyed talking to him and getting that perspective that I usually don't get. I'm all for being open-minded and having it changed a little bit, and that had an impact on me.
I told you you'd like him.
No, you know, I really do. That guy went through a lot, and I mean, I still don't agree with Jody Arias' most disgusting
human being on the
person
planet
in the freaking world. And he made a comment that nobody benefits from the death penalty. I strongly disagree with that.
Right, right.
I'm all for the death penalty.
But I respect his view.
Especially, I do. I respect his view. I respect what he was saying. But he was a joy to talk to. And he was so honest and vulnerable that it was great. Yeah. So, and he's happy and healthy, and that's all
absolutely
I want. That's all I want for most anybody except for Jody. So
I'm just lucky that I consider him one of my dearest friends.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
How you've gotten,
yeah,
you talk about 6 degrees of separation. You're making a lot of connections for a lot of people, Robin. So it's pretty cool. And you got all of us in the studio at once. I know you're enjoying
collective
that, and
yes,
there's no way I'm going to be able to make you cry this week. So
no,
you're way
you can
too
do
happy
that next week, not today.
But I would love to get into Darren's next guest, because talk about 6 degrees of separation. I grew up in Avondale. I lived in Avondale.
And you're a fireman.
When I had my accident. And yes, I have a slight love for firemen. And our next guest,
slight is an understatement,
next guest was a firefighter. So I can't wait to just sit back and listen. And as always, Darren knocks it out of the park with our guests. So Darren,
yeah, this is
what do you got?
It's a great Cop Talk segment, because we have Stephen Johnson, 14 years with the Avondale Fire Department, a stellar career, stellar individual, who saw some horrible things as we do.
Yeah.
However, he saw more and more and more. And so he's created the IH2 Foundation. I'm Healing 2 is what IH2 stands for. I'm Healing 2. And basically, they help first responders feel better faster from unresolved trauma. I love what he's doing now, and I just loved his story. So I reached out to Stephen, and he graciously agreed to come on. Stephen, welcome to Badge Boys.
Well, thank you very much for letting me be a part of this segment. I'm greatly honored.
You know, I can't wait to talk about specifically what you're doing in the high country of Arizona, helping first responders. It's very innovative. It's think outside box. I love it. But if you would, could you tell us a little bit about a little bit about your trauma, sir?
Yeah, I got hired in 2005. I was 32 years old when I made the transition to become a firefighter. And I went through academy like everybody else. And then just a few months out of academy, on July 2nd, 2006, that special tone that all of us firefighters know that goes off in Phoenix and all the stations, that tone went off for me for the very first time. And it's that whirlybird tone. It's the drowning call. And we know that when that call comes in, we're going to the worst moment of our life, our career, and the worst day for a family. And so on July 2nd, about 4 o'clock, when that tone went off, we got in the truck. And I've never seen a fire truck go so fast. I think we actually got all 6 wheels of that fire truck off the ground on a couple of those big bumps in Avondale. But as I came through the house to go help that little kid, the moment my eyes locked on a little 3-year-old boy who was laying on the side of the pool where his granddad had just pulled him out of the water, and immediately my mind flashed, and all I saw at that moment was my daughter. And for the next 20 minutes while we were on scene working that kid, taking care of him, I couldn't help but think, this is my own daughter that I'm working on. We got through that call. As soon as I put the kid on the helicopter, I broke down. I started to cry. I could not contain my emotions. And then we went back to the station. Less than 60 days later, on August 27th, we're standing in the station on NEL day. The bay doors are open. You know, it's extremely hot. I watch 5 cop cars fly by the station like they have an agenda. And I say to the guy standing next to me, I go, we're about to go somewhere. And immediately the tones go off for a traffic accident. And a car that was traveling up 107th Avenue passed Thomas. And then when it got to the canal, it hooked a left and it rolled multiple times through some guardrail, flipped upside down, and landed into a canal where 2 twins and a mom perished. And on that night, I spent several hours there recovering bodies. And I took a little 3-year-old, 4-year-old boy, pulled him out of the car, walked him about 100 yards up the canal, and put him in a body bag because the ME refused to pull the kid out of the car.
Oh.
And after that moment, wow, I was never the same.
And how early on in your career was this horrible summer?
Year one. I was less than a year on the job.
Wow. And you stuck and went 14 years, am I correct?
Yeah. And from that, things just got worse for me. I started to socially withdraw while I was at work. I couldn't stand. Every time the tones would go off, I would literally just hide in my room and I would get on my knees and I would pray that the tones would not go off. And the career that I thought I would love, I soon grew to hate. I went 10 plus years with undiagnosed post-traumatic stress.
And what happened then? How did you get the help? And talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. I had an eye surgery. I had gotten an infection with my eyes. I wore contacts and, you know, you can't wear glasses as a firefighter. So when my eyes were getting bad, I went and got an eye surgery and I was off work for a little bit of time. And then I came back to work. And as soon as I came back, we ran another drowning. And on that drowning, I went through another house, saw another kid, and I flashed back to all the calls I had ran. And on that call, I fell apart. And I visibly and physically started to cry on the call while guys were doing CPR.
Wow.
And then that's when I started to go get help. That's when I said, okay, something's wrong. I can't do this anymore. I got to get help.
And tell us about that. What kind of help did you get? Was it just reaching out? Was there something that transformed into what you're doing now?
Yeah. It's an amazing story. If you believe in God, you believe in a higher power, then this is where God steps in my story. So my fiance, who's now my wife at the time, is a flight attendant for American Airlines. She's on the plane, and a lady named Libby Timmons, a counselor, trauma therapist who works with first responders, happened to be sitting in first class. She gets up to go use the restroom. It's full. She starts having a conversation with my wife. She mentions first responders. My wife goes, oh, my fiance is a first responder. And then the floodgates opened. And my wife started to tell my story about how I was falling apart, crumbling at the seams with uncontrolled anger, frustration. I was just not who I was 10 years ago. And Libby handed my wife the business card, and she brought it home to me and said, you might want to call this lady. And then it sat on my desk for 4 months, where my wife said, have you called yet? No. Have you called yet? No.
Good wife.
So finally I reached out to her. And then I met with Libby, and Libby said to me, sitting in the Starbucks, you have post-traumatic stress. I said, okay. She goes, I can only imagine how you drive. Oh, I said, well, I drive like every other fireman. And she goes, yeah, I get it. She goes, we're going to a retreat next week in Salt Lake City. You need to come. I said, I don't have any money. She said, well, you give me what you got and I'll make the rest happen. And that's what she did. And then a week later, I was on a plane heading to Salt Lake City, where I met 3 other cops from around the country. And the 4 of us spent a week unloading our trauma. And I got done at the end of that week. And I said to myself, this was the best week I've ever had in my entire life.
Wow. Wow. And that is kind of what ICE 2 is all about, isn't it?
Yeah. And so fast forward the story. Early 2019, I put in for medical retirement. I got to the place where I said, I can't do this anymore. I think I'm better served somewhere else in the world. And so I put in for my medical retirement, and that was it. And so then I launched the IH2 Foundation, put in for the nonprofit status. We got approved. And I just started reaching out and talking to other firemen, police officers, EMS workers, and dispatchers about sharing with them the fact that, you know what, you too can heal from the hurt that you are carrying around.
And tell us about this house and what you do and all the specifics about it.
So what we do is we help first responders only. We don't bring in lay people. We bring in just those who understand what it means to be a first responder, because we have our own language, we have our own set of values, we have our own culture. And so we bring in people to help first responders heal and unload the trauma. So we'll take 4 to 6 individuals, and depending where they're at in the country, we'll go rent a house from Airbnb. We'll get a big, nice mansion or whatever it is, and we'll spend 4 to 6 days helping them discover what it is that's hurting them, why they feel like they feel. We'll go over the physiology of trauma, a bunch of just important information. But the core and the crux of what we do is we help them outline their story and where the hurt has taken place. And then we give every single person an opportunity to unload that pain. So when I was in Salt Lake with my guys and with Libby, I spent 4 hours standing in front of these guys, going through story after story after story of my timeline, unloading the hurt, unloading the pain. And the wonderful counselor, Libby, would stop me. And when I wanted to move over something, like it was no big deal, she would bring me back and go, no, 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 let's dig out that. There's a hurt there. We got to heal that. And then, like I said, by the end of the week, man, I was free as can be.
Hey, Stephen, I'm going to pose a question to you for all of our listeners that I think you will be, and somebody who can maybe help me understand. So I still teach our academy, and I talk to the officers, you know, the recruits. You remember what it's like to be in the academy and,
yeah.
And you know, wide-eyed, excited, working hard. I'm going to have a great 25-year career. That's how we all think. And on the devil's advocate side, I can tell these recruits, look, you put your name on the application. I know why I did. And you got to deal with what you see and what you go through out there. However, that's just not reality. We don't know what we don't know. And until you see
that's
it, until you do it. And we had an unfortunate example that's fresh and recent here in Phoenix. You know, we lost one of our commanders a week and a half ago in a shooting. And the two other officers on that scene with him at the time that were both also shot, two female officers, I just taught their academy classes a year and a half ago. And I told them the same stuff. And now here they are. They're going to be facing, not only did they get shot and the things that they heard and saw, but they were the last people to hear Commander Carnicle's voice. They were, they're always going to have to live with, I was there when Car 4 died in the line of duty. Again, we have our own language and our own culture like you talked about. But this is a delicate topic to me, and I want to hear from your perspective. How do you get it across to first responders, whether you're somebody like me who was injured in the line of duty, but it was just a car accident versus, you know, I thank God every day I never went to a drowning call. I prayed every day that I went to work that I would not, at the other end of a hot tone, hear drowning call. And I never did. And I am thankful and grateful for that. You did have to go through that. You did have to pull children out of cars and things like that. So what is your thoughts on for those first responders listening that might be undiagnosed as well right now, what I'm saying about, well, you signed up for this, so you have to deal with it, versus you don't know until you know what you're seeing.
Right, right. So this mentality that we grew up with that existed 20 years ago, which is honestly starting to shift now, but the mentality that you and I came into the first responder world with is that we are invincible. We are rocks of solid foundations. Nothing touches us. Suck it up, buttercup. Get back. Go to the next call. You'll be okay. Man, it's just a bunch of horseshit.
Yeah.
That culture has got to change. The reality is that we are people. The reality is that we are our mothers. We are fathers. We are grandfathers. We are sons. We are daughters. We are people with feelings and emotions. And at times we're strong and certain calls don't bother us. But then there are those ones, And some are less severe than others, but it doesn't matter because one call will affect one person differently than the other. But each of us has to have the mentality that says, I am not invincible. And if I don't deal with what I see in a healthy manner, if I stuff it, if I push it down because that's what I'm being told to do, if I can't come into the station and say, I'm not okay, then we're going to lose first responders left and right all day long.
And we are.
And we are. And that's why the culture is probably shifting a little bit because we talk about that more. But that's a perfect answer because we are still human beings. And what has to change culturally is, first of all, recognizing you can't pour from an empty cup. You have to help yourself. You have to be willing to walk into a station and be like, listen, I'm not feeling my best, and talk to somebody. Doesn't matter who it is, but choose somebody. Yeah. And what you're doing with this foundation is amazing. And I know you've already saved many lives, and you're going to save a lot more. So I thank you so much for that.
And one more time, the website so people listening can get involved.
Yeah. So here's the deal. If you go to IH2.org, and you can come to our site. You can go to a page called Trauma Retreat, and it's got some information about the retreat. Now, we're just updating our site, and we had a big hiccup with GoDaddy, so the new site might be up as you hear this. It might not be, but anyway.
that's normal.
Well, the nice thing about GoDaddy, this is streamed, so it'll be up forever, so think of it in that way.
GoDaddy is causing me massive amounts of trauma, actually. So
you're going to have a retreat for
GoDaddy.
The GoDaddy PTS.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You would not want to have been here yesterday.
Oh, I love it.
But anyways, there's our website, right? And you can go on there. The phone number, you can call me. It's going to ring my phone. I'll be happy to talk to anybody. You can get some information on the retreat. If you're interested and you think that there's no way you can make this happen, you don't have any money, then I would just say to you, you know what? This is why I have a nonprofit. I have a nonprofit because I wanted to help people, but I also wanted to raise a ton of money so that I could make it affordable for our first responders. So the information's there. You can email me, you can call me, and I'm happy to come to any departments. I do a lot of public speaking and training on trauma and how trauma hijacks us. So I'm available to serve whoever, whenever, and however.
I cannot thank you enough, not just for coming on our show, but for what you're doing, helping first responders, and a beautiful message. And for, more importantly, as Jason always talks about, the candidness, humble, and talk about your pain.
Vulnerability.
Thank you. Vulnerability. Awesome. Thank you so much,
Nothing
sir.
More beautiful and Thank strong you. Than vulnerability, right. And I appreciate you so much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Two amazing guests. We had a defense attorney of all things on Badge Boys. But you know what I've said a million times is I've learned more from defense attorneys than I have prosecutors. I really have. They will show you your weaknesses.
That's true. Yeah.
To have a fireman. And again, I know your love of firemen. And what a story. What a story.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of good things. And you could hear in his voice he's gone through a lot and still suffers from it. But he found his path, and he's going to do a lot of good now.
And I consider that heroism.
It is.
I really
of course
do.
It is.
And who better to talk about heroism than Jason Schechterly?
Well, my heroic thing this week is just pretty simple. I want to thank all the first responders out there. And, you know, we had the funeral service yesterday for Commander Greg Carnicle. Not going to let just because the sun came up today and the funeral's over does not mean that we're going to not talk about it or forget about it. But One thing that really struck me yesterday, it's been heart-wrenching all week to know that we couldn't get dressed and go to his funeral.
Support that family.
Because of the quarantine and the COVID. Yes. And I mean, Phoenix did what they could and the community did what they could. But what I tuned in on Facebook Live that Phoenix PD was advertising in, and the one thing that really struck me was how many officers from around the United States put on full dress uniform and stood wherever they were, whether it was in Michigan or whether it was in Boston or whether it was in Washington State, and they joined in a show of solidarity and to honor the Phoenix Police Department and to honor Greg Carnicle. And that was heroic to me, to stand in solidarity in the new world we're in and to do it virtually, but they did it. And that meant something, because it would have been so easy to just be like, yeah, you know what, we can't do what we normally do, so I'll just go on about my business. And they still took the time to do it. So I thank all of them, because they are my heroes this week.
Yeah, you figure there couldn't be a venue big enough for all the love that showed up, because I was looking at the clicks and how many people were involved. It was thousands upon thousands.
And there will be a memorial service once we get back to our normal life in a few months, hopefully, but it won't have the impact of what yesterday did. Yeah. And may Greg Carnicle rest in peace.
Absolutely, brother. Well, the awkward transition for me to go from something so beautiful to something so stupid.
This is when we need our spirits lifted, right?
We need a little laughter.
Are we going to hear about Florida again this week?
You ready for this?
Oh, God. Here we go.
My Florida entry for today.
Here we go.
Two Florida men are charged with drug trafficking. They could have done a better job hiding their wares in this drug trafficking, because they had it in a bag labeled, ready for this? Bag full of drugs. They literally labeled their bag of drugs, bag full of drugs. Yeah, Ian Simons and Joshua Reinhardt are our two brain trusts, both 34 years of age. They were pulled over in Santa Rosa County on Saturday after a trooper clocked them at going 95 miles per hour on Interstate 10 in the Panhandle area of Florida. This is a word of warning to you drug traffickers. Don't go 100 miles per hour when you have a vehicle full of drugs. Pretty stupid. The trooper determined that Reinhardt was the subject of an active felony warrant for violation of probation. He requested a backup, and who's the backup? A canine. But you wouldn't even need the canine, because the canine, even if the canine had no nose, if he could read, he would read this bag full of drugs is a bag full of drugs. Yeah. They found approximately 75 grams of methamphetamines, 2 kilos of GHB. By the way, I shouldn't be laughing at GHB. That stands for gamma hydrobutyric acid. Basically, it is a date rape drug, GHB. Oh, it's kind of like roofies, similar to roofies. Yeah. But anyways, they were charged with all that stuff. Those are our stupid suspects in Florida. So now we're going to go somewhere else. We're going to go to Mississippi. Two arrested after winning lottery numbers were glued to the ticket.
Seriously?
Yeah. Our brain trust, Otis Latham, 47 years of age, and Russell Sparks, he's 48, were arrested by the Flowood Police Department on Monday after the Mississippi Lottery Corporation contacted the authorities about the forged ticket. The authorities said they used super glue to affix the winning numbers to a losing ticket, and then went to the Mississippi Lottery office in Flowood in an attempt to cash it in. The authorities said it ended up being a counterfeit ticket, is what the industry calls a cut and paste. It was visibly a fraud. Now, it was visibly a fraud is code for it looked like shit. Okay, it was visibly a fraud, but we also scanned the front, side, and back, and we double checked, and it was a losing ticket. The duo was charged with conspiracy to commit and the counterfeit instrument for over $1,000, which is a felony, and for using false ID. So if these two idiots had got away with it, then they have to present false ID. Their plan was flawed from the beginning. It was pretty stupid.
If you're going to counterfeit, do real money, not lottery tickets. Seriously?
Yeah, they scan it, you idiots. Okay, and the last stupid suspect story is women. I say that, plural. Women steal stroller from New Jersey store, but leave a child behind. Right. Remember the whole leave no child behind?
Yeah.
These two ladies should not have left their child behind. Three women were caught on camera stealing a baby stroller from a New Jersey store, but their theft was foiled when one of them forgot their child inside the store. They had to get away with stroller, but with no child.
Good Lord.
Yeah, the women were at the Bambi Baby in Middletown, about south of New York City, on Friday with three children. They each had a child with them. Two of the women distracted an employee while the third woman went to the front of the store to grab the stroller. The woman then left the store, but again, the one forgot her child. They had to come back. They figured out what had happened. The two were arrested. They got the stroller back, and there's only one outstanding, and she is definitely not Mother of the Year material. So now, those are our stupid suspect stories.
Wait a minute. I just have to say this. You said Bambi Baby was the name of the store?
It is. Bambi
Baby. It sounds like a stripper name or a strip joint.
It does. And they talked about how these strollers range from $400 to $1,000, and the stroller that was stolen, $300. So not only
they stole the cheapest one,
they stole the cheapest stroller and left the child. So stupid trash. I don't know.
Oof.
Yeah.
You going to save us, Jason?
Well, you know what? I am going to advertise and shamelessly plug an event this week.
Good for you.
Finally.
I know.
I think everybody out there should try and we're all quarantined. A lot of people don't have anything to do. On Tuesday, April 14th at 3 p.m. Eastern, if you go to, you can register right now, but go to EagleRiseSpeakers.com. And on Tuesday, we are, six of us are giving a free virtual inspirational speaking deal that's going to last about an hour. There's going to be six of us. You're going to hear from Jason Redman, a former Navy SEAL who was shot 8 times, Ryan Muncy, Greg Amundson, Inez Barbario, some incredible speakers. And then you get a chance to do Q&A with all of us for however long, and we're just going to be on there, and it's completely free. Just go online, EagleRiseSpeakers.com, sign up, and the inspiration will come on Tuesday.
I love that. Oh. Now, normally when you go on these tours, it's a premium ticket. These are incredible speakers, to include yourself.
Oh, thank you.
They're usually how much money to go in person?
Oh,
I mean, it's quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit. And this is free, and
I love it.
It's virtual. You can sit in your fat pants and be safe and quarantined and just listen to us run our mouths. But I think it's going to be
absolutely incredible. I give
Jason Redman a lot of credit for putting this on for free. And when you hear his story and learn about him,
all your stories to include Jason. Absolutely.
It'll be cool. So hopefully I will get to talk to some of you on Tuesday, but we will definitely be back here next Wednesday. Thank you all. God bless.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.